Yeah, quite a few to come, but that's too bad.
Okay.
Is it working?
Oh, yes.
Good. Does it fit inside a waistband?
No.
Has it got a hook? I don't have a pocket.
No, it doesn't.
I'll just slip it inside then, yes. In that case. It won't fall. I've got too much padding there for it to fall. So, it's actually on and working, is it?
This one doesn't work. Yeah.
Okay, I'll just leave it. Yeah. Fine. Yeah.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Complexity seminar series. We have three seminars in June this year, and I hope you'll be able to join us for most of them. Today, as you know, we'll have a discussion on leadership, as seen from a complexity theory perspective. And our two speakers are Professor Sue Richards, OBE, and Lynn Sedgemore, CBE. I will introduce Sue first of all, and her presentation will be approximately half an hour. We'll have a short discussion. Lynn will then present, and then we'll have a break for tea and then have a really good discussion after tea. You have their bios, so I'm not going to repeat everything that's already there, but just give you a couple of items that you have not actually seen. I asked both our speakers what attracted them to complexity theory, because to me that is a very interesting topic. Sue became interested in complexity in the mid-1990s when she found that silo-based structures did not actually have very good outcomes. And she published on the subject in 1999. More recently, she has been the UK coordinator of what is called the New Synthesis Project. Now, this is quite fascinating. I will just briefly tell you about it because Sue will give you a good deal more. This is six governments that have been brought together by Jocelyn Beaujange, who is a Canadian. And she's an absolutely amazing woman, being able to bring together the governments of Australia, Brazil, Canada, Netherlands, Singapore, and UK to look at a new framework of governance for government using complexity theory. I'm one of their scientific advisors. So I've been involved with it since the beginning. There have been six roundtables hosted, five roundtables hosted by five of the countries, and then there will be an international conference in 2012. So keep an eye on our website, because you will have all the details of the conference when that happens in 2012. So I would now like to introduce Professor Sue Richards, who she will be reading, and that is why we do need to keep the lights up high. So I do hope that you can see the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Eve, and it's really nice to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. Eve and I met for the first time. Lynn and I have known each other for a long time, but we met during the fifth of those international roundtables, which was in London in November last year, and which I had the pleasure and the burden of organising. That was when this little trio was formed. I'm going to talk about complexity theory. But actually, with one of the world's leading experts in that sitting behind me, I'm going to touch on it And I'm going to talk about the context of the public service and the public policy system in relation to ideas about complexity, to the leadership challenges which it faces, and then hand over to Lynn, who's going to speak as a leader and as a theoriser about leadership, about the leadership challenges and how we deal with those. Just to explain the situation here, those in the room who know me will know that actually these days I'm partially sighted. So I find it very hard to look at a computer screen and work my own slides. So my wonderful assistant here, stepping down from her eminence as one of the leading theoreticians on complexity, is going to work the system for me and keep an eye on what I've got here, which should keep us both in sync. I find it hard to keep in sync with when I try and do those things myself. That's our plan, and in terms of following an agenda, setting out an agenda that I need to follow, and just to go back to the partially sighted thing, I sometimes do need to put my notes quite close to my eyes in order to see them, so you'll forgive me when there's occasionally a break in what I hope is a reasonably fluent process about that. It's just, you know, it's something I've had to cope with, and you'll have to learn to cope with it in the next half hour or so. So I'm going to set out a kind of proposition that actually the public policy system is beginning to behave as a complex adaptive system. And that there are lots of problems in the way of that and things that stop it happening perfectly. But nonetheless, I think we are moving clearly into that mode of being. And this quite surprises me that I'm saying this, because actually, until really getting down to prepare for this conversation, I've thought of a complex adaptive system as a kind of metaphor, a guide, something we ought to be aiming for. But I find myself more and more convinced, and particularly through reading some of Eve's stuff, that actually that's where we are. And it's imperfect, and there are obstacles to working effectively in complex adaptive mode, but nonetheless, it's happening. So for me, this has been a very worthwhile process of development to prepare for this. So I'm aware that some people in the room will have been attracted by complexity, and probably your people who come to all of these and are deeply knowledgeable about and have thought a lot about complexity and complex adaptive systems. And you're probably further ahead than I am in that. But bear with me, because there'll also be people in the room who are attracted by the idea of discussing leadership in that context, and who won't have that as a background. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time during this presentation just picking up some key definitions. I'm then going to locate us in the recent history of the public policy system and set out what seem to me some key stages, and then to move into a discussion of what I describe as experiments in being a complex adaptive system, drawn particularly from work that I did as a researcher in the New Synthesis Programme, where with a young colleague I wrote a case study which will be in the book that's going to be published this autumn, on total place at the macro level and a couple of examples of local development in complex adaptive system mode. So I'll just take you through aspects of that. I couldn't resist also, in thinking about examples, of pulling in one from Brazil. It's one of the great delights of working with these six, you know, across six nations in the New Synthesis, was that we have different strengths and weaknesses. And in a way, the UK and Brazil are opposite ends of a number of continua. The UK has long established legitimate state institutions, but has come to override, I believe, community and social factors in how we operate in our public policy system. Brazil has all the community strength of having gone through a liberation process, so all those networks and connections and self-confidence, but as yet weak political state institutions. Being able to map how those things impact on what we do and how we see the world has been very instructive. And then I'm going to finish on just setting up some of the issues that relate to leadership of complex adaptive systems. So that's my plan. Going back to the new synthesis, Jocelyn Bourgon, who Eve mentioned, is the former equivalent of cabinet secretary in Canada, the first woman to hold that post, and I think the youngest person to hold the post in recent times. And those of us who know her speak of her in revered tones. She is the reflective practitioner par excellence, using my best French Canadian accent. She both has been a mover and a shaker at the highest levels, both in Canada itself and on the international stage, ambassador to OECD, working in the UN, and so on, lots of international organisations. But I feel compelled to say also constantly reflecting on the perspectives that she brings and that she develops during that process. So the new synthesis is her idea. She incorporated those of us who were early adopters, and so we set about a process of developing the ideas. And I've put on the slide, which I think will go up on the website, the new synthesis website address. And you'll find on there, as part of the open section of it, roundtable reports from all the five roundtables and some big landmark publications. And we're working towards publication of the book of the project, or the books of the project, this coming autumn, and another big international conference in 2012, as Eve said. Just summarising it, this is a process that says there are some new change drivers around in the world of the 21st century, and public administration needs to adapt to those. And, you know, you can perm any few from a longish list of what those are. There's clearly something about a more interconnected world. There's clearly something about new technology, which is changing the way we exchange information all the time. There's also something about moving to a stage in the world where we can no longer dump on the environment the externalised products of our growth, our economic growth, but actually have to recognise the limitations of growth and change our own behaviour if we're going to survive as a species. All those things are coming on strong as the new context for public administration. So it would be surprising, wouldn't it, if governments could continue in the same way as they always have. In the UK, we have the benefit, or is it the disbenefit, of being an old country? Long-standing public administration traditions, which carry huge benefits, but which are in danger of locking us into place so that we don't adapt as well as we could. can we learn to get better at adapting to the new circumstances, and can we move on? I think we can. I think I want to argue that those challenges are ones that we're meeting. I think I've probably said quite a lot on this, but just the last bullet point or two on the sheet about propositions. I guess what I was struck with, both about Brazil and some of the other countries who worked in this collaboration, Singapore being again another one that you would pick out, is that if you observe how they work, I mean, cut out your immediate thoughts perhaps about Singapore and its authoritarian state. That is an aspect of how it is which one shouldn't ignore, but putting it aside for a moment, I've never seen a group of people who are so good at learning and applying their learning from elsewhere, using it to change how they behave, so united around a common national vision of not wanting to go back to where they were when the British left, of recognising the degree of change that they brought about through their sheer intelligence and capacity to learn and to work together over the last 40 or so years, and determined to press ahead with, you know, relatively little by way of natural resources other than a geographical location that's in a convenient place and the skills of their population. And I find that an inspiration, and I look at home and wonder actually, you know, whether we really can adapt in time. There is a kind of international competitiveness league table, and we've sat comfortably near the top for quite a long time, but others are coming along, and perhaps it's because they're doing things more adaptively than we have been. We need therefore to look to our laurels in this country and to face up to the challenge of where we are. So this is the slide I'm most trepidatious, if that's a word, about. And this is where I try in a very short time to summarise some of the things that I've read in Eve's work and indeed in the work that Eve has inspired in the New Synthesis programme. But here are a few key features of what it means to be a complex adaptive system. I always like, you know, understanding where words come from, and the word plex or braid, as the translation is at the heart of the word complexity. We are all braided together, plaited together, connected together, and that's a recognition, really, of our degree of interconnectedness. We co-evolve. Of course, for a long time, organisational theory has preached about being aware of your environment, remembering to adapt to your environment. But actually, complex adaptive systems theory says to us, you are co-evolving. You are shaped by what other people do. They are shaped by what you do. That is a fact of life. Get used to it, work with it, remember it. We may well be destabilised. In fact, it's a very destabilising time at the moment for the UK public sector. But destabilisation can lead to a new order, a new equilibrium, or many new equilibriums indeed. What it may particularly lead to is the chance to explore the space around you, rather than to be constricted by the path dependency that's built into old institutions. Actually work with the opportunity to explore new options. One of the theorists that Eve quotes, I can't remember the name, but talks about the value of exploring the adjacent space, not going too far off the map so that actually you're in danger of pulling down the house around you, but explore the adjacent space and come up with innovation and new solutions. It's about a recognition that the world that we inhabit is full of feedback processes. They're sometimes negative feedback processes, so that they pull us back to our starting point, laws of supply and demand being an obvious one there. But sometimes they're positive feedback processes which amplify rather than dampen the change process. Obviously, the whole of climate change ideas are built around the amplification of positive feedback loops. So that is something we need to think a lot about, think carefully about. Focusing on self-organisations, it's taken me quite a long time to come to recognition of the value of this. But actually, of course we fit in a system, of course people give us objectives and measure our performance against those objectives, but actually we are living agents, and the world is better if we see ourselves that way, if we work with others to self-organise, we can produce more that way than we can if we go down a strict top-down mechanistic planning process. So what emerges out of that self-organisation will be new things, new findings, innovation, which wouldn't have happened otherwise. And so have the confidence to do that. And just as a final point, then, and this is part of the handover to Lynn, not quite yet, but when we get there, is that actually those who manage and lead the public policy system can enable it to work more effectively as a complex adaptive system, or they can try and stop it doing that. They can try and close it down, lock it down, say, this doesn't fit with our system of public accountability, I am my minister's servant, that's how it works, get into line. So there are ways of hampering the development of the public policy system as a complex adaptive system, and there are ways of helping it, and I'll come on to those. I just, in my next slide, which I won't go through, put up a contrast between, if you like, on the right-hand column, a mechanistic view of the public policy system, or indeed of any other system, that it's a mechanism, that it works in predictable linear ways, and that you can lead it that way. And so I've drawn in those boxes, the contrast between two ways of seeing the world, two ways of being in the world, and I won't go through those because I see time shooting away. So going back to, in a sense, my comfort zone of huge familiarity over a long career, and I think I put the 30 years on because that's me. I became a civil servant for the first time in 1980, so it's 31 years on. Having had an earlier stage of my career as a lecturer in political science at what's now Northumbria University. So for 5 years, worked in Whitehall in the early 80s, at a time when Mrs. Thatcher was beginning to get going, became fascinated by all of that public management, and that kind of set the direction for me. I think what the world of the public policy system, which operated before that crucial 79 election, we can say many things about it, but what we can certainly say is that it was, to a degree, a decentralized system. And I like to use the phrase of Carl Weick. It was a loosely coupled system. There were strong elements of autonomy and power sharing across that, with local government still at that point with quite a high proportion of its finance coming in through direct taxation, called the rates in those days, with professional bodies working relatively autonomously within an overall framework of policy, but with huge scope for professional development. And with central government operating some centrally run big machine bureaucracies like the benefit systems, and also operating in the political sphere, but with an only a loose connection to public service. This is a relatively stable, workable, adaptive system with, in a sense, the central bits focusing on the politics and the local bits concentrating on, local and professional bits, concentrating on working towards better outcomes. I mean, we can have an argument later on about whether it did produce better outcomes, but nonetheless, I think that's where we were. What we got really in the next 30 years, I would argue, is a tightening up of that loosely coupled system. So, first under the Thatcher regime, breaking the autonomous power of local government, deprivileging the public service professionals. This was a phrase that was used at the time. I think I'm looking around, I may be the only person old enough to remember that in the room, but nonetheless, that was a phrase used by one of Mrs. Thatcher's advisers. And I think if we go, you know, beyond 97, it's a fairly mixed picture, really, because, you know, part of what that Blair government was about was compensating for the free market liberalism of that earlier period by dealing with some of the social problems that had accompanied it. So we had a kind of Anglo-American capitalism model and also social justice. That's a kind of brief description of the third way under Blair. And on the social justice side, actually quite a lot of interesting complex adaptive system type things were done. And indeed, they'd not been absent in the previous stage. But what came to dominate the Blair period was not that, but actually a tightening up, a ratcheting up of the centralised, mechanistic approach to doing things. And the word targets came to denote first a purposive, achievement-orientated, action-orientated government, and then as it kind of seemed to go over the top for many people, became hugely discredited. And, well, they may regret it now, but I think many public service professionals didn't vote for Labour in 2010 because they just had it up to there with detailed targets. Actually, the system was changing again by then. I come on to that. But nonetheless, there was a kind of loss of support, loss of legitimacy for... We'd reached the end, really, of centralisation in quite that form. And where are we now? Oh, well, God knows. It's your guess is as good as mine. Chaos theory. I mean, clearly, you know, PR and marketing specialist David Cameron has come up with a big society as something he can see has an appeal which is a you know, counter to both the reputation of free market liberalism of earlier times and also the target-driven statist approach that he characterises Labour as having. But there's a lot of, you said it, chaos. There's a lot of getting used to being in power going on at the moment. And one of the disadvantages of having watched all this for 30-odd years is that you think, God, how can they not know that? because, of course, you have a continuity of observation. But as each new cohort comes into power, they have to learn it for themselves. They have to, you know, they have to get to grips with things. And so there we are. So I'll flip over this quickly, but then move on to total place and spend most of my little remaining time on that. I just listed their experiments with being outside this paradigm, because actually, even right back through the Thatcher period, a lot of it under the aegis of Michael Heseltine, but nonetheless, core part of activity around the urban programme or various initiatives that came to happen under that general rubric still took place and still happened. And there's something about the notion of place in our system which is very powerful, very strong, people identify with, that pulls us back into working in complex adaptive system mode, despite the dominant model being something other than that. Some of the things that were done in the early Blair period were also very definitely outside the paradigm. A wonderful Sure Start, which was sort of based heavily on a long-standing American program, came out of the Treasury. My good friend Norman Glass was the only begetter of it. It was, instead of being a tight program, as many other programs under Blair were, it was a loose tight program. It was tight on just a few outcomes, key outcomes, but loose on how Sure Start projects would achieve those. In other words, allowing local level players to use their judgment and use their thinking about how to achieve this. And there are lots of things to argue about in that context. The last one I want to pick up, though, is total place, and just say a bit more about that. And probably, I think, finish without doing my last two slides. So, I think I've looked at this in some detail, and it does seem to me, this is what convinces me that actually we've reached a point where the public policy system will become a complex adaptive system. And the old models will start to degrade and disappear, and people will cease to have expectations that they work that way. And a key element in this, I think, is, well, two key elements. One is the now interpenetration of the leadership cadre of Whitehall with people who have strong experience outside Whitehall at local level, and many of the key players in Total Place had a local government background. Michael Bichard, I mentioned there, he used to be my boss at the Institute for Government, where I was a senior fellow, but had a strong career record both as a permanent secretary and as a local authority chief executive. But many others were in the same sort of mode as having worked in both areas, and so had multiple perspectives, had experience, life experience, that led them to work in complex adaptive system mode. The two key people from the Treasury, Ray Shostak, Director General, who was led on the operational efficiency programme, Helen Bailey, the Director of Public Service in the Treasury, former local authority chief exec, both the permanent secretary of communities and local government when Total Place started, and his acting replacement when he moved jobs, and the permanent successor to that, all with strong local authority backgrounds. So people actually now are the system provides a different mix of people, different experiences. And the other key driver, I think, is that we've begun to realise just how expensive a mechanistic system can be. It didn't matter, in a way. Of course it mattered, but it didn't matter too much when we were in the early part of this century. There seemed to be enough money to pay for, you know, constant new programmes, constant bribing of local players to work together to achieve better outcomes. But actually, we're not in that phase anymore. And already by the time Total Place was set up as a programme, it was evident that we weren't, and that we needed to find new ways of being more efficient in achieving outcomes. There'd been what I think is one of the best white papers in recent times, called Excellence in Fairness, which a number of people I know claim to have authorship of. But it was a white paper of, I think, June 2008, and it said, in future, we need to think of the whole public policy system in terms of central government having a strategic leadership role rather than micromanagement, of trusting and engaging with frontline professionals, and of working for and with citizens in new ways to achieve what citizens want and need. And I think those principles were kind of key to what had been learned from that 30 years. And I just hope that, in the new circumstances, we'll come to, with a new government, we'll come to recognise the long-term validity of those principles, put aside a label on Total Place. It's actually about a much more fundamental process of learning to be different. And indeed, the new government has instituted a programme called Community Budgets, which takes the principles of Total Place, builds on, has 16 pilots, works with, in the field of communities, of families in crisis or with complex needs, and learns the lessons from the past. Now, there's two specific examples in my presentation of things that were done. One of which is, and we worked on these local projects for the new synthesis, one of which looks at Croydon, which found that its acute response to childhood malaise was building up and building up cost. And so partnership working across the primary care trust local authority divide set about actually finding out what the real problems were, and together, not just at top level but also through those organisations, working through what the solutions might be. Very fantastic creative facilitation in this, done by Ruth Kennedy. Good use of anthropology, video ethnography, to allow those people working in their little bit of the system to see how it looked as a whole, and to learn from that and to develop new ideas. And some of those new ideas are on that. Another example that we looked at was Swindon, which was not a Total Place pilot, but one of about 80 what were called para pilots, which was, okay, we're not in this process, but we're going to do what we want to do anyway. And very, very interesting bit of innovative development work, facilitated by the organisation called Participle, one of whose heads is somebody who cut her teeth, in fact, in Brazil, in the liberation movement there, and a disciple of Paulo Freire, and taking the most excluded, the most difficult families, who are hugely costly for the public policy system to deal with in conventional ways, and working with them, living with them, so that they too can find a route back into being effective citizens. So it's, you know, it's working with the excluded. And I once did, on the basis of the figures that they produced in the Swindon project, I once did an extrapolation of what we could save if actually we could somehow replicate the results in avoidance of, in early intervention, avoidance of further interventions in health, work, and crime, and so on, across the you know, across the range of public service, if we were more effective with such families at an early stage. And it does beg a belief. I mean, there's a lot, of course, between making that calculation and achieving that efficiency, but it reinforced for me, you know, it doesn't quite cut the deficit on its own, but it gets halfway there, or nearly halfway there. It is absolutely astonishing how inefficient our mechanistic system has been at dealing with those issues. And so, you know, it's an illustration, really, of the driver. I can't resist just mentioning Brazil. Are we all right? We're slightly running over. But I think we've got a long afternoon, so we've got a bit of scope. This is something that the Brazilian delegates to the New Synthesis Programme talked about. About 1990 or so, they had a very, very high HIV infection rate. And they're a developing country, and obviously, you know, in all sorts of connections with the World Bank. The World Bank recipe for this is that you need to ration. You need to work out how you're going to, you know, make cuts in other services in order, and make rationing in the service on HIV infection in order to survive as a nation. And that's tough, and you're going to do it. You're going to kind of gird your loins and do it. And instead of following that recipe, what they actually did was draw on their strengths as a society that's been through a liberation movement and put the problem to their community. Don't ask me the details of how it's done. I'm not familiar with this. But I know that it was done, and that what resulted in that was an unconventional solution, not a solution you'd expect an institution like the World Bank to come up with, which was, you know, put aside, a big pharmaceutical has, you know, gets its reward elsewhere. We are actually going to produce generic versions of antiviral whatever's, and we're going to do that, and we're going to do all the caring and the connection and the education through using the strength of our community. And so we'll come up with a different solution for our problems. And as I was reading this, I was thinking about the frequently cited, how can we have anything like the current NHS given the coming problem of the baby boomers getting old? I am that baby boomer, and I am, you know, getting there, thankfully still standing. But it was an inspiration, really, as to actually how you can tap into the hidden strengths of the wider community to work with problems and to self-solve and to move things along. So, you know, if you need inspiration in this world about how to move forward in public policy system which has new ways of solving problems, go to Brazil. It has many other problems, but there's an appetite and a positive learning there for change that I think is very impressive. So I'm not going to go through my last two slides, but they do carry all sorts of implications for what kind of leadership we need. It's clear that we need people with multiple perspectives. It's clear that we need people who can carry values that are about how do we get the best out of this for citizens, and it's clear that we need to develop those skills. There aren't enough of those skills and that orientation around. I believe that there is a huge untapped public service, public value orientation in our world of the public, and I think we better damn well use it and use it effectively if we're going to move forward and solve our problems. But so that's the end of my story. I also am extremely interested in leadership. I was Director of Strategic Leadership at the National School of Government. Before I went there, I was in charge of the leadership programmes run by the School of Public Policy at the University of Birmingham. So I'm really fascinated by how real leaders make sense of the world that they operate in, how they start to adapt to enable that world to develop, and how they avoid being imprisoned by the structures within which they operate. I think it's possible to reshape the rules of the game. I guess I'm speaking to civil servants in the room. If you don't think so, then think back to what happened around coalition formation. We, I believe, would now have a minority government and possibly be gearing up or have geared up for another election had it not been for the activities of Sir Gus O'Donnell and others around him, who invented a constitutional doctrine about the need to create a bit of breathing space within which coalition formation could happen. They did that for very good reasons, because they believed the bond markets would destroy our currency if there was no overall control of government and there was no obvious way forward. So they were acting for the best, but it nonetheless was a constitutional innovation, an innovation in the rules of the game that made it possible to achieve change. I strongly believe that it is possible to adjust our rules of the game of public accountability so that we're no less accountable, but that we're no longer drawn into the top-down mechanistic system that seems to lock us down and stop us moving. So, that's it.
Thank you very much indeed, Sue. I would like to take a few questions before we start with Nilina. As I said, we will have quite a lot of time for discussion after tea. But some any questions at the moment that you may have for Sue? Yes. Can you say who you are, please, and where you're from?
Yes. My name is Ed Rose, and I'm from South Bank University. So I enjoyed your presentation very much indeed. I was with you throughout the whole presentation until the end. But
Right.
Leave that aside.
Are you pessimist?
What I just wanted to ask you about is, from time to time you made reference to appropriate education and training systems that, in your view, produce the kind of culture that supports complex adaptive systems. You used two very distinct examples. One was Singapore and the other was Brazil. Both countries represent very different experiences from our perspective. I just wondered whether you'd like to just comment on where we might need to make some changes within our own education system to produce the kinds of leaders that you're thinking of that might take us out of God knows where we are.
That's a very good question. Thank you.
Yes. Cheers. Got the healthy answer. I can't give you a kind of full answer, but let me give you an answer from the sort of learning and development and training of practitioners area. And I very strongly believe in the value of action learning and appreciative inquiry. That process, almost that scientific process, really, of taking yourself out of your action, giving yourself stimulus. And for those who are familiar with this, I'm thinking of the Kolb learning cycle. Giving yourself stimulus, it's going to give you pause to reflect. So, you know, doing something unusual that takes you out of your comfort zone. Maybe it's a visit to, you know, if you work in Whitehall, maybe it's a visit to Bradford, my hometown. Not that I've lived there since I was 18, but I do go back all the time to visit my family. So, you know, somewhere with an entirely different worldview, interacting with people there, giving you pause to reflect on where you are and what meaning you might make of your experience, and how you might, having understood the meaning of it, and the, in a sense, the theoretical explanation of it as played out in practice, how you might then go on to experiment in being different in the way that you act and behave. And I think this is a very powerful learning cycle. I've worked with, you know, programs of leadership development that were explicitly based on that, and I think that you know, that's one of the kind of ways we ought to move forward. That we should kind of move away from the notion that, you know, here's a substantive set of knowledge and skills that you need to acquire in a kind of a contextualised way. Of course, you will acquire those as you go along, but it's the meaning making and the learning to move to a different place through that meaning making that I think is significant.
I think what is very important is a change in fundamental thinking, which needs to go from the earliest school years right up, because a lot of our education is focused very specifically on particular disciplines, on particular micro areas within a discipline and so on. We need to change that around to see the interdependencies, to see much more holistically, and the fact that we cannot focus exclusively on one dimension, because most complex issues are not just social or just cultural or just technical or just physical or just political. They have multiple dimensions. But we are educated, we are trained to think very specifically in a very narrow field. And although we need to keep the depth of the development of that knowledge, at the same time, I think we need to widen it. And I think that's one aspect. And the other is to think at multiple scales. You mentioned that it is not just a top-down approach, but you need to involve the citizen, you need to involve local governments, you need to involve people at regional. And I think, again, thinking at how do we involve individuals and groups and communities at multiple scales at the same time. And that is, I know you're asking about training, but I'm talking about a different way of thinking. And until that way of thinking changes, we are not going to change the way we are governed or of leadership. And I think that's absolutely fundamental. The new leaders will need a new set of skills, and seeing holistically is going to be one of them. But there's a lot more, and perhaps we can pick it up later in the discussion. But thank you, that's an excellent
And I just want to come question. Back on your throwaway point about being with me all the way to my last point. Actually, I have experienced Whitehall at a senior-ish level now for the last 5 years, being inside it. And you would be surprised, if this is the point you're making, at the ferment of commitment to achieving outcomes in a complex adaptive system that there is. That's not everybody, and they're all aware, I think, of how they're limited by the way the current rules are interpreted. But nonetheless, there is something going on there that is of huge value to the society. So I can't prove that to you, I can just assert it.
Thank you, Sue.
Yes, sir.
It's very interesting presentation.
Again, please tell us who you are.
Yes, Saeed Ashot is Liverpool University Associate Complexity.
Thank you.
In terms of the effectiveness, yes, and the efficiency, if you like, taking into consideration the current time for the recession and the credit crunch, do you think there is an opportunity to promote creativity and innovations? And if that's so, you agree with it, how are you going to market it and develop it regionally? There are good regional examples for Swindon, Croydon, and you know the Northwest Liverpool, we have to go into the details of the regeneration. I've seen very good models. Yeah. If you agree with that, thank you.
I absolutely do agree that you know, if our old way of doing things was very expensive, as I think the last decade has proved, then we've got to find a cheaper way of doing things. And lots of good Northwest examples I could use. I think I know Merseyside and Greater Manchester are, you know, bound together by common enmity, but and I did go to Liverpool University myself, so I'm definitely on your side, but I can't help remarking that actually the 10 local authorities in the Association of Greater Manchester Authorities have actually, you know, made the pace really at working together around these common issues. And Mike Farrer, the head, I don't know, he still is, of the Strategic Health Authority in the North West, Liz Meek, head of the Government Office of the North West, there are a whole set of players there who are, you know, have been really moving ahead on this agenda and who are, I think, role models to follow. Some of them, you know, may not survive the current chaos. I don't know what the Strategic Health Authority up there is, what state it's in at the moment, but nonetheless, they show the way. They are pathfinders, I think.
Hi there, I'm Tony Drewer. I'm an independent facilitator and coach. I'd like to pick up on something that Eve talked about the general reductionist views that we promulgated for so many years. And I see your comments that a holistic thinker tends to behave differently, and the body politic of reductional thinkers tends to reject that kind of thinking, and so the holistic thinker never gets promoted.
No.
In fact, they're labelled as, in a polite way, there might be disruptive influences, though I've heard much stronger.
Yeah, yeah. I've been there.
How does one shift that kind of system?
Yeah. Well, the odd thing is, you know, despite what you say about the political thinkers being reductionist, that is true of some aspects of how Parliament operates, but it tends not to be true of most politicians. You know, I think they are natural engagers, coalition builders in this, with a small c, and they see the big picture, many of them, and somehow, you know, because of the old rules of the game, we kind of turn them against their natural, or their, you know, the competence they've developed by becoming senior politicians to do that. Now, that sounds slightly idealistic, and I am aware of very many who know that their careers depend on getting the next headline, and that comes from developing the latest micromanagement, you know, kind of initiative, and or, you know, in case of the wonderful Eric Pickles, getting on the phone to the editor of whichever it is that you're of, you know, Fleet Street organ you're talking about, to kind of blame local authorities for making the cuts that he's, you know, he's kind of made them make. But you know, so there are games being played, and there's a, you know, there's that sort of aspect of politics. But I think if we could harness, you know, the positive, you know, what we need is more Richard Leeses taking the leader of Manchester City Council, who are actually able to see the big picture, know that their people depend on the achievement of that big picture, look for the positive, guard against the negative, but, you know, there are... I think we should not see politicians as the restriction. We should work with them to enable them to be the full leaders that they can be.
I think part of it is also our expectations, because partly is that we expect results very quickly. And therefore they respond by wanting to do things, to achieve things in the short term, when some of these very complex issues cannot show adequate results in the short term. They do need a much longer term in order to play out. And therefore I think it's equally our responsibility to change our expectations. Because, you know, taking for example the targets in the NHS, most of them were met, but at what cost? The, you know, other aspects in hospitals and so on actually suffered for the specific target to be achieved, but they needed to have something tangible in the short term. Yes.
So, just to pick up on the NHS point, I did a little work recently with a senior dental consultant, Guy's, about management of dental costs, and you know, applying whole systems thinking to map very expensive dental treatment. And what you discover is the latency is 30 years. Because by the time people are getting into their late 30s and early 40s and accumulating, you know, £15,000 worth of dental expenses, actually it's a lack of dental care and good dental habits acquired around when people are 7 or 10. That's when people learn how to clean their teeth for themselves, they learn about diet, and those basic lifestyle practices have a 20, 30, 35 year lag.
Interesting.
Hence my story about Swindon, you know, the vast billions that actually getting it right at the beginning could lead to a saving.
Absolutely. Thank you. So, if you can join me to thank Sue, because... you needed that response. Lynn Sedgmore said, Cindy is currently the executive director of the 157 group of further education colleges, and she advises me that it's the FE equivalent of the Russell group. Again, I asked her, why complexity theory? And Lynn became interested in complexity. She's pinpointed it to 1989, when she actually started her PhD in transformational leadership. And what she found was that, in fact, she was out of sync with her peers. She saw things differently. Her teams worked differently. The interesting thing is that the way her teams were working actually had results, had positive effects. And she needed to understand why there was that difference. So I think, I hope that she will give us some insights from her experience into that. Thank you, Lynn.
And she's still trying to find out too. And yes, I'm one of those people that people have tried to sack and get rid of on many occasions. I've carried the shadow of organisations a tremendous amount. Thank God I've learned not to have so much of it these days. But I've constantly got promoted, to my own surprise, as well. And perhaps some of that will come out in what I'm going to talk about. I just want to share some experience. I'm the leader who's been experimenting outside the paradigm since she can remember, without permission. It's much easier for me to ask for forgiveness. I very rarely ask for permission. But what I'm going to actually end up with is an experiment that was permission. It was the Centre for Excellence in Leadership, the FE, the National FE Centre. For leadership, which was a conscious experiment.
We should have put
the
piece. Yeah.
Have you got a pocket?
I have, yes, that's fine.
Okay, so I am actually going to focus on what we did in an organisation that was a conscious experiment, set off by Secretary of State, Alan Johnson, at the time. And we were asked to really look at new paradigms in leadership and to be an experiment in our own right. I'm going to start with a quote. The ability to assume complexity is a great strength. You could call it the ability to deal with reality.
That's all 1997 Reflections of a Siamese Twin. And I think what Sue was talking about there is actually the national structures catching up with reality. Those of us who are on the front line, those of us who are in our communities, I've been a college principal, I've worked in colleges in adult education for a long time, we usually know how to sort it, and it's frequently the funding streams, the target regimes, and the processes and systems that surround us that tend to get in the way. And I have spent my life fighting, arguing, going round them, through them, over them, to enable what somebody told me. I was head of Dean of Croydon Business School, Croydon FE College. Somebody said, Lynn, the reason everybody wants to work for you is because you create oases of freedom and performance. And actually, when I look back on it, it was right, because basically people felt very free and very able to get on with it, highly trusted, and boy, did we perform. I haven't been part of a team, and I do see it as a co-creation, that hasn't overachieved massively. And in that overachieving, you get the freedom to start to shift and change and book the system. Okay. So for me, complexity theory and theories that foster and facilitate complexity, because I think there's a mix of those, are ultimately about, as a leader, being able to see and experience the world, the reality around me, as interdependent, as highly complex, as interdependent, and so on and so on. I have always tried to surround myself with people who are there already. If I have a senior team who know what I've just said, then magical things happen. And I've also made it my responsibility and duty as a leader to foster and facilitate others in being able to get there. Okay, and that's what I want to talk about. And when I was chief exec of Cell, we really did go to that place. Now, the models I have drawn on, Maslow, certainly self-actualisation, Bill Torbett's work, Jane Lovinger's work, Action Logics, that was the breakthrough conceptual model for me. I discovered Bill Torbett's book, Power of Balance, in 1989, read it, cried, because here was somebody who saw the world like me, went and did the sentence completion test, rang him up in America, got him out of bed at 5 o'clock in the morning, I remember that. And so I got to meet you, and came up in a very similar place to him on the sentence completion, which was a magician at that time. So that was quite interesting for me. Spiral dynamics, complexity theory, spiritual intelligence. I love Keith Grint's work around wicked issues, elegance and clumsy solutions. And I find lots of people that I know working in certainly in FE and the NHS like his work. I shared a platform with him in Northern Ireland a few weeks ago. Heitzberg's adaptive approaches. I love Wilber's integral theory. I know academics usually hate it, but I find it really, really helpful. And the author I can never pronounce, the Hungarian author, begins with a C, very long name, on flow. Yeah, and actually I've experimented in organisations on the level of flow that the staff are experiencing, and the mystical literature of unity and oneness, and I describe myself as a corporate mystic. So I don't tend to come through an ecological approach. I wish I did. I feel very guilty about that. It just doesn't turn me on very much, but I do recycle a bit. Where I come through is actually being a mystic. So my whole sense of being in the world is I know a reality of interdependence, of oneness, of unity, etc., etc. So it's how do I live that in a daily life? From where I've lived in the public sector, I think there are three things that enable a leader to allow a complex adaptive system to flourish and grow and perform to its maximum. The first one is the capacity of the leader to hold a space for emergence, paradox, flow, creativity, learning, co-creation, to let people have the answers or the questions themselves, and to trust it. Now, that's so easily said, and I cannot tell you how hard that is to do. Okay, I'm an English graduate. My first degree was in Keats's Negative Capability. People know that. I love that. Keats wrote about the ability of a true artist, really, or a poet, to be able to cope with ambiguity, to be able to stay with it, to see the value of it instead of run away from it and be frightened by it. So that whole notion, if you don't know it, look it up. It's wonderful. It's Negative Capability. So that's the first one. The second one is being able to see the patterns that are around you. And as you grow in your developmental aspects, that emerges. So it's seeing the patterns, feeling the disharmonies, knowing when something's not quite joining together, seeing the whole system. One of the things we did at Cell, we were quite a small organisation, we moved offices 3 times so that the whole system could be in the same room. The difference that made to how we performed as an organisation. The third is fostering organisational structures, processes and relationships, particularly peer working. I don't think you can really get this complexity, this high-performing organisation going, if, particularly as a chief exec, you can't peer work. I'm not saying you're everybody's mate and you absolve your authority and responsibility, but you are prepared to work in whatever the functional requirement is. So you can be the chief exec, you can be a team player. It's much more... People always say to me, like, I get what working first amongst equals means when I work with you. Yeah. And again, you can't explain that. Because that comes out of the respect and the knowing that we're all interdependent. It isn't something you wake up and think, oh, I better do this because it'll work. You can't help but do it. But when the crunch comes or there is issues, you take the full responsibility of being the chief exec. So it's 3 things. It's this capacity of the leader to hold, seeing the patterns, fostering the structures and processes. Some of us in further education have chips on our shoulders because we're the Cinderella service and nobody's noticed us and that feels bad. Some of us don't mind that place at all because it means you get left alone. And even better, it means you're the place where you can experiment. And FE is probably the most complex adaptive part of the education system anyway. And it's full of rebels, baby boomer rebels like me, who entered it because we couldn't cope with the school system. We weren't sure about universities. So we found FE. So it's been a huge laboratory for experimentation and creativity. Now, what I'm going to do is talk about the Centre for Excellence in Leadership. I've been a senior leader for 25 years now, so I've been fluffing around the system in a senior leadership role for a long time. I was 30 when I was made a senior leader. And I'm on my 3rd chief exec job. So this ability to experiment and to play with all these theories and concepts is great. But what I know all the time is what I lead and co-creating, because to me leadership is co-creation, has to perform. I have been so outside the paradigm sometimes that if we hadn't been performing, some of those senior people would have loved to have got rid of me. Loved, and one chairman did tried really hard. But you know what was interesting? The whole staff rallied around me and wouldn't let him do it. I'll never forget that till the day I die. But anyway. And the reason I've got away with it all the time is because our achievements have been outstanding. So Centre for Excellence in Leadership was a conscious experiment, which was, as I say, Secretary of State level, ministerial level, national quango. That wasn't really a quango. And we were set up as a small business. And we were given a remit. There were 11 academies altogether. But basically what we did in Cell, we were told to bring 1,500 leaders through in 3 years, to be self-financing in 3 years, and so on and so on. In 5 years, we brought 40,000 leaders through the system. 40,000. And the reason I say that is because we're really proud of it. But also, it was why and how did we possibly get 40,000 people to come through and to engage with us? And it's because we saw ourselves, the senior people that we put in post and the board, and about 50% of the staff, saw organisations as an ecosystem. We didn't kind of have it on your interview, but it's almost like the law of attraction. We started to attract people. So we located ourselves. We actually drew our organisational chart. I couldn't find it last night. I was looking for it. As a almost like a hologram. So it was all circles with stakeholders and interrelationships, and it was something that was recognised in the organisation. Like, we got it as an organisation. And we networked all the time. We felt connected to our purpose, and we had passion. Even those who didn't like us respected us and knew we had passion. Now, what I've drawn out, which I thought would be most useful for today, is five key elements that basically this organisation, which really did work from complexity, as I say, instead of 1,500, we brought 40,000 through. We made at least $500,000 to $1 million profit a year, which we ploughed back in. 98% customer satisfaction, 82% market niche, a significant repeat business, and we evidenced impact and improvement. So on every line, the civil servants monitored us extensively, almost daily, we performed on. But I think what was most wonderful was the staff's experience of when we produced the cell book and all sorts of things, because they said it was magical, it was nourishing, it was rewarding, it was growing. And all the people who came on our leadership programme spoke very highly of them. Now, I think it was for five reasons. One, the state of being and development that not only I held, but that the board, the senior team, and a lot of staff held. Those of you who support leaders, there is nothing harder than letting go of control in the public service because you are so measured and monitored and so on and so on. But I know in my own work that really understanding my own ego needs, personality traits, and being able to step out of the way in true service is the only way a complex adaptive system can really, really flourish. Because there has to be a level of trust that allows things to emerge. And staff know if it's there and it isn't. They know if it's there and it isn't. And myself and my team worked really hard on that. And we modelled that and we supported each other with it in terms of inquiry and reflection, constant learning, our own negative capability, the power of appreciation and invitation rather than direction, seeing reality before us without the baggage that you bring in, and constantly going for win-win. And we lived, breathed and ate diversity. It wasn't an imposition. It was something we loved. It was part of who we were. So that state of being, and I do think to get leaders in this new paradigm, we have to somehow have leadership development that's fostering new ways of being outside that comfort zone and going beyond traditional ego need into post-conventional or second tier, depending on the model. The second one is fostering a liberated peer community. And that's top down and bottom up. It's having structure and flexibility and scope to constantly change. And it's having spaces of possibilities, oases of freedom, and generating those. What we did in Cell, we did a conscious process of democratising strategy. I am fed up of being a chief executive in an organisation where everybody bashes the strategy. So everybody was invited to co-create it, absolutely everybody. So we had a vision, we had clear targets, we had accountability, we had ownership and co-creation, but there was masses of room to innovate and to change it and to say how it should be done. And that was respected. And I always remember we had no blame culture unless you were really taking the you-know-what, and then that got dealt with. But basically people would say, you don't get blamed in cell, the worst thing you can do here is disrespect anybody else. It was about very much about that. We had a coach for everybody. We had the system in one room. Everybody was invited to have self-awareness tools and to nourish their inner life. We had regular away days and spaces to speak and discourse. We had fun. We had brown paper lunches. There was constant dialogue, conversation, creativity, and nobody was ridiculed. And the frontline staff were given incredible freedoms that they'd never experienced anywhere else. Junior staff, although we didn't actually use that word in that sense, but they were junior staff, were given budgets and all sorts of things. The other element is strategy. We had two plans, the traditional plan for the department and the funders that we could tick off, and right, that was my deputy's job. We also had linear diagrams and circular diagrams. It depends who you talk to, the one that you took. Okay. And then what really was the strategy was what we called the constantly emerging plan of sensible possibilities and experiments. And we use that language. I call it dynamic steering. It's like, you kind of know where you're going, you've got your values, you've got your vision, you've got your commitments, but actually something really good comes up here, you go for it. I remember the board giving me a really bad time about not being brave enough, because I only wanted to double the budget in 2 years, and we tripled it. Right? And like we said, we could never have made up all those possibilities. We didn't know that they were there. And I should have this big debate with my chair about whether I was visionary or not. Because they thought visionary was, you got it and you said it and off you went. And I thought vision was, no, it's something that you half discover as you go along the way. But anyway, I think that's really interesting. But we always exceeded the targets. Always. Without fail. We didn't know how we'd done it sometimes. Processes, communication, dialogue, totally transparent information, delegated budgets, bottom-up organic networks. We did brilliant work around sustainability. It was all from two people who were passionate about it, and we let them do it. And we gave them the budgets. We constantly changed people's job roles. They'd come in and say, I don't do that anymore. I really want to do this. Well, is there a place for it in the organisation? Let's look at it. Yeah, there is. Hey, that'll really add value. Yeah, go for it. And that was how it was working. They allowed people to make real decisions. No perks for senior managers other than pay. You walked into our offices, we didn't have separate offices, there was nothing. And that was about this peer community, really. And it didn't bother us. It didn't bother us. There was just something about you wanted to just be part of the system. And we brought researchers in. We brought external evaluators and researchers and people to feed back to us. And then my last one on that is learning. Actually, everybody had a coach if they wanted it, diagnostic tools, we had forums to share, we had a quiet room, a prayer room, the kitchen. We had amazing things that happened in our social spaces. In FE, they'd all been stripped out through budget cut. And we said, no, we are going to have a wonderful kitchen where people can socialise and eat together. And we've got researchers writing articles on that. Team structured evaluations, open staff meeting. Anybody could ask for meetings and forums to come together in that way. And emails. I've never had such a ball with emails as in cell. People would set off a train of emails. And they were all... The thing about it was everybody was very respectful with those freedoms. Nobody abused it. I'm not saying we didn't have performance issues and things like that, but nobody abused it. The shadow side, does anybody know spiral dynamics? No? Okay. Well, we got Don Beck from Spiral Dynamics to come and work with us. And we looked at our own shadow side as well, and it was about being arrogant. for those who, I think only a few know, I mean, we were mostly, we're very orange, mostly green, with quite a lot of yellow. And there was an arrogance about us, which we thought was passion. But it was very much perceived. It was really interesting, that dialogue, because it didn't feel like arrogance from the inside out. It felt like passion and commitment and going the whole mile and all that. But for we did not relate to other national agencies very well. We got bored with them. We didn't like their discourse. You know, we kind of like, oh, catch up a bit. Yeah, that's arrogant. Yeah, okay. We were insufficiently linear for the civil servants, although we did try and find ways. I look back now, and we're just writing the book ourselves, actually. But we look back, and we've had dinners afterwards, and when we think of some of the things we said and did to the civil servants, it was provocative. We didn't mean to be, but we can look back now. We didn't really, really relate to that. And I think there was suspicion, fear, as well as admiration from the civil servants. They was like, we don't know how you're doing this. We don't get how you're doing it. And we didn't take time to explain it in ways that made sense. We were too loud in our marketing. We flouted our successes. Basically, we didn't really respect the upside of bureaucratic organisations, and we went to war with too many people. The reason we had 40,000 people came through is we designed programmes and interventions and services for every action logic. We did actually use the Talbot action logic, the sort of the 7 levels, but we used the 5 levels. So every leader who interacted with us, if you wanted a toolkit, you got a toolkit. If you needed a process, because you were moving into post-conventional leadership, you got a consultant who knew how to lead you through that. If you were struggling as an achiever, stroke somebody who needed to be performing, you had people in to support you to get your business plan sorting your bottom line. So we had a holistic frame, so that every point of interaction, it was a big tension with the board at one point, because they wanted us to have, say, half a dozen lines that we stayed with, and we had 32. So people were panic-stricken that we had too many. But actually, there was a point of interaction to everybody, but it was. And we did experiment with very leading edge. We did horse whispering. We got away with it. Though the horse did bite one of them, but she didn't mind. We were in tests. It was on tests, and we made the reporter do it. And lo and behold, he had a real revelationary time. He thought it was fantastic. I did lose sleep about that one. We put people in tents, looking at their leadership identity. And I had to remember when Kim Howells was a minister, I was called up to Kim Howells because some of the principals had walked off and said it was like being in therapy. And I said, well, tell you what, Kim, if they're still complaining in Module 3, sack me. But this is where they're supposed to get uptight about it. And luckily they didn't. We did presencing. We got people, I really believe, I think one of my answers to how you get young people to be different leaders is you get them to sit quietly, to know who they are, to look at their whole beingness, not just IQ and physical intelligence, but emotional intelligence and other. And I went to MIT a few years ago, and they got all sorts of games that they were developing in Stanford for children seeing systems. It was amazing, and doing that. So we really did experiment at the leading edge of leaders shifting. And you know when somebody's at the point at which they're looking to change their leadership styles because things haven't worked, or they need to go from good to great, or they've tried everything. You know, the most heartbreaking is those leaders who are like doing more of the same and it's not working, and then they need to shift. So we did a lot of work about that, a lot of work with actually the Bath Consultancy Group, those leaders who are still trying so hard but they need to shift their paradigm. And I think really the work that Sue and I did in relation to a presentation we did for the other programme was that post-conventional ways of leading really need to be able to inquire and act in real time to respond very cleanly and appropriately. So we need more focus on vertical and integral individual development, you know. And for many people, they make that shift into seeing the world as more complex when it's things like divorce or breakdown, or when something happens in their life that what has gone on before just doesn't work anymore. And I mean, you wouldn't wish that on anybody, but sometimes that is the way. Or you get people like me who just inquire all their lives about things. Enabling people to see the system and its interconnections, deeper self-awareness, action inquiry or real-time inquiry, collaboration, co-creation, all those enabling people. But I'm still on an inquiry, and I look forward to the discussion after break about how. There's two questions that I've got that I think I'd like to end on. How can complexity theory be made more accessible and usable to leaders in their daily life? It took me a while to really get into complexity theory. There's a wonderful book called School Leadership and Complexity Theory by Keith Morrison, and he draws out four diagrams, and I got it then about how it related. The book itself is fantastic, but just seeing it in this way, somehow for me as a busy daily leader, I got it, the difference, particularly this diagram. I have done some handouts about the nonlinear systems, diversity networks, organisational learning, order without control, self-organisation. And just like as a leader, I thought, oh, yeah, I work within those circles. So I think it's how do we make it more accessible? And how can leaders be supported and encouraged to see and lead their organisations as complex adaptive systems by academics and consultants? And I know some of you are doing that work. But there is something about those people who need to go through those journeys to see it differently. And how do we help them to do that? Sue and I, the first piece of work we worked on consciously was on the systems, looking at what systems leadership meant for the whole public sector. And everybody, every leadership centre was struggling with how to do that. So I'll finish now, I think.
That's great. Yeah. Thank you very much indeed. I think a lot of the work we've been doing for more than 16 years now has been actually focusing very much on creating what we call enabling environments. Yeah. And that is precisely what you have just described, but giving it a structure and giving the details. And I loved your 5 points, which I think we need to pick up after tea. Tea's ready?
Excellent.
So there is tea and pastries outside. Can I ask you to please be back exactly at 4 o'clock? We need to start again, so you've got almost half an hour. There are Lou's also right next door. Thank you. But first of all, before you go, again, please join me to thank Lynn.
And I've got a suggestion for you. And before we start, what I'd like to do is to I know it will take time, but I think it's of value to ask everyone to say who they are.
Yeah.
Because yeah. It's fair enough the ones that ask questions, but I think we need to actually know who,
yeah, who everybody is.
Who, yeah.
She mentioned that.
Yeah, let's turn that off.
Yes, and some of them will have done a lot of work in this.
Yeah.